Welcome to episode 448 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Kasper Pedersen. Kasper is a Danish triathlon coach who is working with professional athletes, junior and developing athletes, as well as age groupers. And he's probably most well known for being an important part of the team around Magnus Ditlev. He's usually the man on the ground there to help with day-to-day coaching and support during training camps and races. And in this interview, we discuss Kasper's very interesting entry into coaching, his coaching methodology, specific advice on various topics for age group athletes, and we get an in-depth description of Magnus Ditlev's training in preparation for his second place finish in Kona. Before we get into this episode, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. Whether it's a caffeine gel before a sprint triathlon to give you an extra boost, or a full-on carbohydrate and electrolyte strategy required for an Ironman, getting your fueling and hydration right can be the difference between achieving or not achieving your goal. And Precision Fuel and Hydration have products that make it as simple as it can be to get your fueling and hydration right. You can easily fine-tune your intakes to your carbohydrate, sodium, and caffeine requirements, ensuring that you get the most out of yourself on race day. Their gels, drink mixes, and chews are easy to digest, making them a reliable choice for any endurance athlete. And you can get a free fuel and hydration plan for your next race with the fuel and hydration planner on the Precision Fuel and Hydration website. And as a That Triathlon Show listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Kasper Pedersen. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Kasper. How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I'm doing really good. We were so lucky that we were able to speak yesterday and now also today, as we had some issues with the technology. But I'm all good, and I'm really appreciative of being on your podcast. I've been a listener for many years and feel quite privileged to be one of the coaches that you want to interview with so many top coaches on the podcast. So thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm really excited for this chat. And as you say, we are warmed up now after yesterday, and we also have somewhat more disk space on our hard drives. So everything.
Yeah.
Let's start with an introduction. Can you tell us a bit more about your background in triathlon and as a coach?
Yeah, I mean, there's maybe two stories to it. I think most people maybe know me as like a member of the team Magnus Ditlev, and as a best friend of Magnus, I'm basically traveling around the world with Magnus for races and camps, and I'm really happy to be a part of that team, as we have some really competent people around Magnus. And I think being in the team of Magnus, working with Magnus and the people around us, gather so much experience and stuff over the years, which I've been able to take with me into my coaching. But actually, before meeting Magnus, I was actually already into coaching. So I've been into coaching now for close to 10 years. I started into the sport by doing triathlon myself for a couple of years. And then alongside my high school, I was asked to be a part of the local triathlon club where I already trained at, actually. And it was like without any experience in coaching or so that they wanted me as kind of a title as a head coach sounds like really much responsibility. But I mean, when you're working in a niche sport as triathlon, and a head coach in the local club isn't the biggest of a achievement. But I was happy to take that position got into coaching that way. And pretty quickly, actually, I found it really inspirational. I was mostly working with junior athletes. And at first, it was maybe like, or mostly just getting them into the sport, going out to the local races and make sure that they had a good experience within triathlon and wanted to continue with it, even over high school and so on. But then in 2018, 2019, I think, so that must be, 5-6 years ago, unfortunately, I got diagnosed with some heart issues, which kind of made an end to my own pursuit of a professional career in triathlon. I actually just signed up for getting a pro license and was aiming to race the Ironman 70.3 Dubai as my first professional race. Unfortunately, I didn't manage to even get to the start line as the heart issues put a stop button to that pretty quickly on. But then I was in a quite good position where I had some good people around me, and I was able to kind of switch my, you can say, my ego and focus on myself into other people. So I decided to, as in that period of time, there wasn't really a, what can you say, a big network or like focus on talent development in Denmark. So I decided to, within my local triathlon club, which I was still the head coach of, to really try and establish a really good like junior national program there, and kind of put it all my focus eventually into that project. And by the end of it, I ended up having 5 or 6 athletes on the national junior team. And in general, I mean, that is an accomplishment, of course, but it was more, I was really happy about the environment that we kind of built it. I mean, I think it's really rare that, from my perspective, that you see young people in the age of, like, I think they were 11 to 15, 16 years of age, like, being so dedicated into the sport. I was really influenced and inspired by what you've seen in other countries, for instance, where you're living in Portugal or Norway, etc., where they have a really good kind of foundation of and program for junior talent development. So I tried to kind of take that, inspiration from that into my own program, and just, building a nice and good surrounding for the junior athletes. And I've basically been working with the junior athletes up until, recently this summer, where I decided to move from an area around Copenhagen to basically the opposite side of Denmark in Aarhus, together with my girlfriend, as she's living here. And that was obviously one of the reasons, but it was also as I wanted to challenge myself in new ways, as I've been working with the kind of junior talent development program for close to 10 years. And obviously, due to my increased workload with Magnus over the years, then I've also get to work with more professional athletes. So I kind of wanted to establish a new base where I had different opportunities to be able to travel with my professional athletes, because when you're working with junior athletes, and at least the way that I was doing it, then we had kind of weekly scheduled sessions together. So my ability to be able to travel out with Magnus or Ruth or Clement at that time, Marjolaine, etc., wasn't really there. So it was much better for me to kind of establish a new base and system around my coaching where I was way more free to travel. That is my current situation, where I'm now based in Aarhus. Maybe going a little bit deeper into my relation with Magnus, because I don't really think that everyone knows the story about it. They normally just see me scream on the outside of the broadcast, giving him splits and everything. But we actually started as training partners in the local triathlon club, where we met each other there. And then we pretty quickly became best friends. He was obviously a way better triathlete than me. So also when we attended to do some racing together, he basically just kicked my ass every time. We became best friends. And then actually when my heart issues began to be quite problematically, he was really the one that was there for me. And I think that's where also our relation really got to a new level. And he actually asked me in the first place to become his manager, because at that time, back in 2019, that was where he really tried to pursue his own professional dream. And I think he had his first professional race that year as well in Challenge Davos. And he actually just asked me to become his manager, as I've always been quite good at talking with other people, brands, etc., and just the whole marketing part of it. And Magnus, he is, as the listeners may know, he is really, like, he has gotten quite outspoken actually, and when you know him, he has a lot to say, but he really just wants to focusing on his training and just be able to execute on race day, and he's not that much into social media. So I tried to the best of my ability to kind of create a brand around him, and at the first time I was the one kind of securing his first sponsors and everything, and I did that for the first 2 years, and that's actually also why I have a bachelor degree in sports management and marketing. That was actually based upon the fact that I wanted to be in a position where I could help Magnus to the best of my ability. But then I think we worked like that in 2 years, and we actually established a company together where I was kind of managing the business side and he was managing the sporting side of it, of course. I don't think we expected that Magnus's level would just like rise to the level it is now so quickly. We kind of expected that my capability within management and his capability within performance in triathlon would kind of be fairly equal, so I could kind of develop my skills as well. My learning curve wasn't as fast as his. So we decided that it was better to kind of part ways in the fact of the management and sporting side, and him being able to have a more experienced manager. And he's currently working with Patrick Lemire, who is outside of being the husband of Gwen Jørgensen, Olympic gold medalist, etc. Then he's a really, really great personality, a great manager, and is working and helping in way many other areas than just the management side of Magnus. So we kind of ended that in 2021. And then naturally during to the fact that I've been working as a coach for so many years, it was a natural part that I would still be a part of the team, but more as kind of an assistant coach. It's really important for me actually to testament that I'm not the head coach of Magnus. There is a lot of people that think that when they meet us, but I don't want to take away the work that Jens Petersen Bach has done with Magnus over the years. He was the one that kind of pulled Magnus from being an age grouper into the professional world of triathlon. He used to be a professional triathlete himself. So not to say that I'm not helping or working with the coaching side of Magnus, but I don't want to take the credit for all the work that Jens has done. But he's just got his second child. And as he used to be a professional triathlete, I think his kind of quote of traveling away from home and be away from his wife and everything is kind of, it's very limited at the moment. So that's where we come in a good position, where I was actually used to be coached by Jens, and Jens and I have a really close relationship, and I kind of see him as my mentor in coaching. He's always been really available for me if I had any questions. So it works really good in the way that we have kind of the same philosophy around training. So whenever Magnus, for instance, now we're going to Dubai next week, and we've just been in Kona, that then I can kind of help with the day-to-day decisions or the decisions within the moment where we maybe can reach Jens or so, because I know what Jens probably would have told Magnus and so on. So that relation is working really well. So I'm really happy about my current situation and happy about that I've kind of managed to get my kind of hobby into my profession, so to say.
Yeah, that's a super fascinating story, and a lot of things that I absolutely didn't know. The fact that you were Magnus's manager for a while there, just jumping in at the deep end and getting some sponsors, that's really cool and interesting to hear. So at the moment, your role within Magnus's team, and then you coach a few other professional athletes, and I believe you also coach some age group athletes. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I'm obviously a part of Magnus's team, but beside that, I've been working in the past with Clément Mignon, Marjolaine Pierre, and also for a short amount of time I was working with Rasmus Svenningsen. But as of for now, I'm working with George Goodwin, who is trying to kind of bounce back from a couple of difficult years. So it's been a really interesting journey. I started working with him by the beginning of this year and kind of getting him back to the level he was at. And then beside that, I'm also working with Ruth Essel, and recently just started working with Fiona, who is an Irish triathlete, but she's actually living in Bend, training with Paula Findlay and Erik Lagerström, which maybe the listeners know about. And then on the side of that, I'm still coaching a few of the junior athletes, even though I've moved away from the junior team. There was kind of a natural process where, like, there was a few of the junior athletes that is still racing European Cup level racing, which I still wanted to help out, as I've been working with them basically since they were 8 or 9 years old. So kind of going away from that is quite difficult for me. So I still have two junior athletes racing European Cup level racing on junior level, though. And then three junior athletes who is now racing or taking the the step from racing short distance into professional 70.3 racing, two in Denmark and one in Australia. And then, as you're mentioning, I am partly working with age group athletes as well. That is something I've done, yeah, basically since I started, actually, but it's always been a minor part of my coaching. But by the beginning of this year, I started working closely together with Matt Fox from Sweat Elite. He's the founder of Sweat Elite, which I think also the listeners know quite well with all the great training videos and so on. But he recently actually started a coaching company, which is running really successfully, and he's coaching a lot of runners. And then we decided to actually create a triathlon coaching department within Sweat Elite. So we started this year, and that has obviously brought together a few more age group athletes, but it is still something that I'm not able to take in, let's say, 30 or 40 age group athletes a year, because I'm quite picky about who, not to sound arrogant or so, but whether it will be pro athletes, junior athletes, age group athletes, to me, honestly, it doesn't really matter that much. But I really want to work with people that is collaborative about having the same dedication, work ethic, philosophy, because I think in that way we'll be able to create the best results together. So it doesn't really make sense that because I am so passionate in what I'm doing, that I think if I'm working with someone that isn't as passionate as I am or dedicated, then we will in both end just work like above each other or under each other. So that wouldn't really make sense. So that's also why I'm quite picky about who I want to work with.
Yeah. So let's dive into some more specifics around how you coach. So if you can give a high-level overview of your coaching principles and training principles that you tend to use.
So I think it's quite a difficult question to answer, because I think if you look at all the training methodologies that is out there, I mean, in 1 year, then it's threshold training and the Norwegian method. And then recently it's been more like zone two, and probably going back to maybe some high intensity and so on. And in the end, I think we need a mixture of everything. It depends on the athlete's history, where the athlete is at the moment, and where the athlete wants to be in the future and in a couple of years. And then I think now you're asking into coaching and training methodology. And I think in many ways, those are two different things. And I think that's also why you can easily go out and buy a training program for, let's say, $10 a month or something like that. Because in the end, it's really easy to put a training program down into a paper or into Training Peaks for an athlete. That's not what is difficult. But what is difficult about it, and where I think that the coaching part of it comes into it, is that, like, to execute what has been written into Training Peaks and being able to execute the training consistently, in whether it will be a training camp environment or at home or leading into races when you're traveling out to, for instance, from Europe to the States or the other way around. And I think that's where the coaching part of it comes into play, and why I maybe that's also maybe my strongest side, I think, because based off the fact that I started working with juniors, where, like, I started working with them without any experience. And with juniors, it was really pragmatic, if you would maybe call it that way, that, like, it was really looking at kind of trial and error, and really looking into, okay, how were they feeling? And when they came to the pool, okay, I could easily see if they had a long day in school, if we wanted to regulate the training just based on how they were feeling. So it was really much based on the communication and not so much on lactate measurements and testing in the lab or so. But that is something that I have added on to my coaching over the years, and especially in my work with Magnus, because he's obviously really scientific for his things and really wanted to kind of turn every stone. So through my work with Magnus and just my evolution into coaching, I obviously added that on, but I'm really happy that I've been able to kind of work with coaching and especially juniors in the beginning of my coaching, because I think that had added on to the coach I am today, where I really highly appreciate and put a lot of emphasis into the communication with my athlete. Because I mean, every coach can go out and write 8 times 1K or 4 times 2K threshold on the program. And like every athlete can go out and train really hard for a week or so and basically just kill themselves in training. But it's the like relationship between the coach and the athlete, and the coach kind of task to be able to make sure that the athlete is consistent over weeks and weeks and months and months and year and years and years. So to maybe answer your questions in a more just short version is that I really highly use the communication and the relation to my athlete as kind of my methodology, so to say, because I think with the training spectrum of things, I mean, threshold can be a really important part of the training, but zone two can also be a really important part of the training, and VO2, etc. But it's really individual, and it comes into certain parts of the season or the yearly schedule for the athlete. Because if one athlete is only doing threshold for 10 years, then the athlete will be really limited in their metabolic profile, and you need to have kind of all aspects of your physiological profile. And especially with the racing we are seeing nowadays, where, I mean, just as an example, if we take Kona, which I know we'll dig more into later on in the podcast, but seeing the way that Christian, Magnus and Sam race, for instance, like you are not just swimming your own pace, going out and biking Ironman pace and running your own pace. I mean, you really have to act to the certain situation within the race. And I mean, that was what we saw with Christian and Magnus at Sam, that they really needed to act on each other's kind of attacks during the races. And I mean, I know for a fact from seeing Magnus's file and obviously talking with him, but also Sam and Christian, that they were not just riding consistently. And it wasn't necessarily because Christian and Magnus bonked it in their Ironman pace. I mean, there was a natural reason why they bonked, and that was because they were basically racing short distance for the majority of the bike leg. So, I mean, because of the modern racing of triathlon, you need to have all aspects of the training physical profile into your training, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. I guess one interesting way that we can discuss it is what are the methods that you use to decide what type of training an athlete should do in their next block? So, you can talk about things like looking at race files, race demands, but also the athlete's physiological profile, or just like more pragmatic profile in terms of how you see them during training. What different factors would you consider to decide on more focus areas, I guess, for an athlete?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I am looking at the physical profile, and I mean, that's one thing of it all. And I'm obviously also doing some testing of my athletes going into the lab. I mean, for instance, when I started working with Clément Mignon, who I'm worked with from 2022 to the end of last year, that once we started working together, one of the first things we did was that he came to my place in Denmark, and I took him into the lab, and we did a physical profile testing and a metabolic profile testing of him. And what we saw, which was quite interesting, I kind of knew that from a fact of just speaking to him, and also the way that he has been able to race prior, is that he is really anaerobically strong, and I knew that he had really like high power. But also, like, we could easily see that we needed to kind of work differently with his metabolic profile, because he was like even riding from him what felt like maybe 1, 2, or 3 RP out of 10. Like, he was riding and running and swimming with a really high lactate. And I mean, the lactate is one thing, but the lactate showcases us how kind of the metabolic stress on the system, and how we are using glycogen, carbohydrates and fat as energy sources. And he was basically, even in a really, really low intensity, he was really demanded of carbs and working predominantly on carbs, actually. So this was one area which we wanted to work really much on, was kind to get his fat oxidation up and being able for him to be able to work more efficient, because it wasn't necessarily because he couldn't ride the given numbers that was needed during an Ironman leg or swim front pack, for instance. But we kind of calculated actually that and this is maybe quite a interesting insight, is that when he got out of the water in 2022 at the Ironman World Championship, he basically came out of the water with maybe 9 to 9.5 millimole of lactate. And during the ride, he was basically riding maybe with 5 to 7 millimole of lactate. And I mean, I know it's, for some people, it might sound really weird and odd that you can actually be able to swim and ride with such high lactate values, but it's also just because he was so dependent on carbohydrates. And this obviously made it an issue for him by the end of the Ironman, because on the run, he was basically just depleted and it was impossible for him to kind of get those carbs back in from what he was burning. He was basically, I think, maybe burning 600 to 800 grams of carbs an hour during the bike, for instance, and it's just impossible to replace those carbs during an Ironman even, and even if you did some kind of carbo loading. So we were really trying to work to get him more efficient in his Ironman pace, for him to actually just be able to execute his run fitness in an Ironman, because I think he's never actually been able to do so. And I think now, just using Clément as an example, we saw in the Ironman World Championship in Nice in 2023 last year, that he was actually able to swim with the front pack, which was the first time for him. And he was able to actually break away on the bike with Sam. I mean, that is, people can say that it obviously was maybe too an aggressive ride from him to go with Sam on that day. But I think actually, and also talking with him, it was actually because it was a hard effort to break away with Sam. But it wasn't necessarily because he was just on the limit, but I think just due to the fact that his metabolic profile and efficiency just wasn't there yet. He's still a young guy. I believe he's 25 years of age now. So with just being able to do the right training for a couple of more years, then he will, in my eyes, actually be a great contender for the win at an Ironman World Championship. But he was just not there due to his lack of efficiency. I hope it answered your question. But yeah, I'm looking at all parameters, like the history of the athlete prior, metabolic profile testing in the lab, and then obviously also the pragmatic stuff by just talking and communicate with the athlete. And I mean, it is a dynamic process where I think that one thing is that we can see something in the lab and we can see that, okay, this is maybe the athlete's limitation. But another thing is that you don't win your races by doing lactate measurements or doing lab testing. You win them by being the one who crosses the line first. And like, you don't win the race by having the lowest lactate when you cross the finish line. So I believe that if the athlete maybe come out after a race and can actually feel that, okay, it is not necessarily just a metabolic profile, but there is maybe some other scenarios that we need to practice within the training for him or her to be able to execute to what we want to accomplish in the races, then that is obviously also an area which you need to take into consideration when scheduling the training around the athlete.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer and a very good example, which leads me to another interesting question. This is actually one of my favorite questions because I don't really have an answer, but I'm very curious to hear what other people have to say. What is your perspective on training strengths and training weaknesses of an athlete? I mean, I think it's fairly easy to say that, well, you should probably do both, but which one is more trainable, do you think? Which one should have more focus and at what periods and so on? Can you discuss a bit your view on that?
Yeah, I think if we're looking, is you mainly thinking about age group or professional or both now?
Let's say professional here first.
Yeah, because I think with the modern racing of triathlon nowadays, then it actually become quite simple. Like, you just can't have a weakness. I mean, let's look at Magnus as an example. Like, even though we know that he is basically one of the strongest athletes out there, that he still has a small weakness on the swim. Like, if we take the Kona swim, for instance, he got out of the water 1 minute and 20 seconds behind Sam. But he was actually with the front group up until the turnaround point of the swim where they are swimming back home. But he got, I think he was kind of in a fight with, I think the same happened to the other Dane, Christian Hugenhaug, where there was basically one other athlete that kind of swam over them, and Magnus lost 10 position within that group. And then because of his current swim level, like he's just not in a position where he's able to bridge that gap up again immediately because the swim speed is just so high. So due to that small area and mistake, or yeah, you can call it mistake or just unluckiness, that then he just lost that front group. And that basically ruined his race, in my opinion, because if Magnus was able to stay with that front pack, he was able to bridge away on the bike with Sam. And Sam and Magnus, instead of playing that cat and mouse game that they were doing out on Queen K, where they were basically ripping each other's legs apart for the run, that basically just destroyed it. But that was due to such a small, unlucky or mistake in the swim, which basically not destroyed, because I mean, it would be unfair to say destroyed Magnus's race by becoming second, but I think he was just able to hold on to it. But we know for a fact from training and also what he showcased in Rust, for instance, early on, that he's capable of running way faster than what he did. So I think the modern racing and professional racing, and especially on the men's side now, and I think we're also seeing it on the women's side coming closely up. I think the women's field is maybe 4 or 5 years behind the men. So I think within a short amount of time, like you cannot just have a weakness if you want to be able to fight for the win in the biggest races. So you need to look at all three disciplines and at all times be like training them to the best of your ability. I mean, maybe one person that can train the swim a little bit less is Sam. I know for a matter of fact that he's only swimming 4 times a week, but I think that's maybe also just due to their training philosophy, that they kind of structure this training around the swimming in a different way. But I think across all three disciplines, you need to be 110% focused on your swim, bike and run, and be in a position where you want to involve that across the whole season. Because if you stop involving or stop focusing on whether it will be the run, bike or the swim, then eventually you will be one step behind. And once you're one step behind on this level, then it's really difficult to bridge that step up again.
And what about, how would your answer change if we're talking about age groupers?
Yeah, I think that is obviously a different case, because with the age groupers, for most of them, though, I know there is a few age groupers that is privileged enough to train full time, that there you can focusing more on specific areas, because you also is time limited due to that there is other prioritizes in life, and thank God for that. But I think maybe for an age grouper, it will be the swim, because as we're seeing now with the dynamics in the age group fields, even there is a lot of drafting going on. And I think that if you're not there on the swim and in the front, being able to sit in a good front group on the bike, I mean, and this goes also, of course, into the personal races, then you are just not in a really good position unless you can run really, really fast by yourself.
Mm. And so we can stay a bit on the age group topic, and then after that we'll discuss more about Magnus's training into Kona. Starting with the age groupers before that, I want to hear a bit about how would you think about the prioritization, first of all, between prioritizing working towards event specificity or prioritizing working on the athlete's physiology? And we kind of maybe touched on this a bit, but can you elaborate a bit more on that topic?
Yeah, I think the short answer will be that I will kind of put myself in the middle, because I believe that you need both parts of it. Like in the base building phase, you are maybe more looking into kind of the internal stressors, which eventually will be lactate and heart rate, where you're not necessarily as focused on the pace. I mean, we should remember that lactate or heart rate, for that matter, it's not a fixed number into a fixed pace or something. It can differ quite much from day to day, depending on your recovery and so on. So like running with, let's say, 2.2 millimole of lactate isn't necessarily the same pace on a Tuesday as it is the day after, due to so many factors. So at that part of the base building phase, you're maybe more looking into that. Whereas then when you're going into the more race specific part of the season, you're maybe more looking into the external factors, which eventually will be pacing or power on the bike. And if you have set yourself up well after a great base building, then naturally your lactate and heart rate would also be in the right intensity within your race specific paces or powers, where you want to train your body's availability to be efficient at race pace. So yeah, that is kind of a middle thing, because you need both areas of the picture.
And what about prioritizing managing training stress versus prioritizing managing non-training stress?
I think that is most likely over to managing non-training stress, because I think for most age group athletes, it's not the the volume of training that eventually will be the limiting factor. The limiting factor is the kind of training that you can put in. The limiting factor for the age group athletes will always be how much volume they can actually eventually get in, because they have a family life, they have work, most of them have full-time job, etc. So it's not because working on getting a specific intensity and also on and managing that stress of it. I don't think that will be the limiting factor. But if we're able to make a program that is suitable for the athlete in terms of managing the stress around the training, then they will also be in a better position, whereas they are more happy. And if they have a kind of a good network and team behind them of family and friends, then I think eventually they'll also be able to perform better on race day. So I think if we're able to managing the non-stress around them, then we're also able to managing the training load for them way better.
Yeah, I agree with that. And finally, what do you think about age groupers doing a higher proportion of intensity because of the lower training volumes versus the proportion of training intensity not really being dependent on training volume per se?
I would maybe say for age groupers, intensity will actually be the most important factor. But I think intensity should also be seen in different perspectives, because with intensity, I'm not only meaning that if you have 6 hours of availability per week, that then you should only be working like VO2 max stuff and really being getting value for your money. But I think intensity is that we are just making sure that with the time availability that one athlete have, that we are then working really structured and detailed into the exact intensity that is needed. So I think maybe even with an age group athlete, if we take away the financial part of it, of being a professional and results orientated perspective out of the picture, then I think maybe for an age grouper, the kind of the importance of having the right intensity in the specific sessions is maybe even more important for the age groupers, because they are so much more time limited than a professional athlete. Because I mean, if you only have 6 hours of availability of training per week and only doing easy aerobic stuff, then I mean, I don't think you'll come such a far way. But again, it also depends, of course, of what the goal of an athlete is. If that is only to finishing an Ironman, then you can get away with just doing easy aerobic volume. But if you have a certain time in the horizon that you want to reach, maybe going sub 10 hours or so on an Ironman, then you obviously need some more specific work, and then you need to dial in the intensity within the sessions.
Yeah. And if we can get some tips within each discipline, so if you have a couple of tips for age groupers for improving their swimming to start with.
That's a difficult one. Because I mean, with the swimming especially, there are so many things. But I would maybe say the first tip would be the breathing. I think that is for many people a limiting factor. I mean, you can take even the strongest and most resilient athlete from, let's say, just the local fitness center, or so, taking that guy or girl into the pool and make them swim 25 meters. Or a very a marathon runner into the pool where you know that their efficiency and aerobic foundation is really good. And then after 25 meters, they are basically out of breath and they are getting so tensed in the water because they're obviously lacking the technique. But I think that also, for most parts, come down to their breathing pattern. And I think if you're able to get in a good breathing pattern in the water, then you'll obviously get more oxygen into your system, and you'll be able to relax way more and not be so tense in the water. I really believe that the more relaxed you can be in the water, the better your body position will also be and the more efficient you will be. So that will kind of be my take on that. The first thing you should work on is your breathing, because once you get that right, I mean, even though you have a fairly decent technique and so on, if you're not able to breathe correctly, then eventually over a certain interval of time, you'll get so fatigued because you're not efficient and you won't get oxygen into your system.
Yeah, and even more than that, I think that even if you don't have the problem, you're a bit more advanced, so you're not getting out of breath, but I think a lot of technical errors, other technical errors, like let's say a scissor kick, often might come from the taking the breath at the wrong time, basically getting the timing wrong of the breathing, or just lifting your head out of the water, those sorts of things. There are so many technical errors that where the root cause is the breath. So yeah, I think that's a really good tip. And do you 100%. Have one other tip that you would give?
Yeah, I think that will maybe be getting some external feedback. You maybe know this yourself, Michael, but even when I'm in the pool, sometimes I can feel like I'm swimming like Michael Phelps or so. And then when I get sent a video or someone sees it and gets me feedback, it's a completely different perspective they have on my swimming. So I think getting some external feedback, whether that will be swimming with the local club, have a coach on deck, or maybe I have some athletes that when I'm coaching them remotely, they have a GoPro. It's not every pool though that is allowing it, but having a GoPro where they can record themselves and also send it to me, and then being able to get some feedback, because it's just difficult and crucial for one to kind of be giving yourself feedback in the water. Obviously, you can have a good sense of it, but I believe that if you haven't been swimming since the age of 4 or 5, if you have done so, it will still be difficult to kind of correlate yourself in the water.
Yeah, 100%. And what about cycling? Do you have a couple of tips to improve your bike?
I think getting a power meter, from what I've experienced with, especially working with age groupers, is that when I've started working with them, once they've not had a power meter and then they have translated into having a power meter, that I often see that they are actually going too hard on the easy stuff. And then on the intensity, they are not able to actually produce the given intensity or power numbers that we want. And I think with a power meter, it is like it just gives you instant feedback, and it's really reliable feedback on your session. So I think being able to have a power meter where you can then polarize your training and making it more detailed and individualize your training, because you cannot just focusing on pure speed when you're doing intervals, because you will have so many external factors that is playing into how your speed is on the bike, and even the heart rate that is also influenced by so many things. So even if you're tired or so, naturally your heart rate becomes way more, like it becomes quite much lower. So if you're then trying to go into, like, let's say the 140 or 150 range on intervals, but you're maybe quite fatigued, it can be quite difficult for you to get into that intensity or heart rate zone, and then eventually you'll be pushing too much power and dig a hole of fatigue for yourself. So I think buying a power meter would be a good idea. And then one more thing will be fueling. I see that a lot of people also, because the bike is something that if we look into most people's training, it is what adds up most volume in their training. And also that's quite naturally, because obviously the bike leg in a triathlon is percentages wise where you use most time, but where you're using most time is also where you need to be focused more on fueling. So I think being able to fuel your sessions, because when you're going out for a 2-hour, 3-hour ride, if you're only fueling with 20 or 30 grams of carbs an hour, then eventually by the end of the session, you will be quite fatigued. And if you, for some reason, is able to get through the workout, then it will just influence your recovery afterwards in a negatively way. So I think focusing on nutrition, both prior, during, and after your bike session, that would be a really good idea.
Yep. And finally, the run.
On the run, I think polarized training. That is obviously it goes also to the swim and the bike, but I think especially with the running, as it's the weight-bearing sport we have of the three disciplines. So there's also this like quite a big impact for our bodies to run. So if you're going out for an easy run, I think being able to actually keep it easy, not only for your aerobic system, but also just for like your joints, your bones and muscles, etc., it will make sure that you are able to recover way better, and also being able to actually execute your intensity sessions, because you're just more fresh and not as fatigued. So I would say doing polarized running would be a good tip. And then secondly, I know there is a lot of pros and cons for this, and I mean, maybe as much debate as there is about Trump becoming a president. I think as many talks about strength training, it's the same. But I'm actually quite much into strength training, and it's something that I've seen paying good evidence for my athletes, not only from like a physical profile, but also just strength-wise. And recently, I've also started working way more close with Laurens van Lingen, who is the previous, like, you can say, physio and strength coach of Jan Frodeno. And he is working with Ruth, and now also started to work a little bit with Magnus, actually. And I really like his approach to strength training. I mean, if you look into the runner's world, you often hear coaches says that on the days where you are running hard, you also want to add in your strength training, because then you will have the most time to recover from the strength training and don't go out and run with like fatigued legs and so on. Whereas with Laurens' approach, it's way more, also if the listeners out there know him from his Instagram videos and so on, like he has a kind of a really different view on things. But I really like his philosophy about that he wants to see the strength training as something that will make you feel great and something that actually can set you up well for a session. So with his philosophy, we are actually applying the strength training on the days before an intensity run. So it can either be, let's say, if you have an intensity run in the evening, then sometimes we can actually do the strength training in the morning, more as an activation set for your body to be able to firing on all cylinders, and also neuromuscular actually be able to fire the right way. And I think with this approach, because it's not only because we are doing core specific work and not lifting. I mean, he's for instance also working with Taylor and Flora Duffy, and I mean Taylor and Ruth for that matter as well, and Magnus is lifting quite heavy actually, but it's just with really short like reps, a few reps, and but with really long rest. So we make sure to not deplete the system and create a lot of lactate acid, because then the body is able to clear it quite fast. And then once the athlete goes out and run, bike or swim, the whole movement pattern and system will be activated in a good way. And I think if you look at it the other way, where if you are strength training on the days where you are then tired, then when you go into the gym, you may be lifting with a wrong movement pattern. And then the day after, when you go out for a run or swim, then if you are fatigued and you're really tense in your muscle and you feel stiff, then you'll also be working way less efficient, both in the water and on the run, and work with a wrong movement pattern, which eventually will create injuries. So I can actually see that by doing that, you can maybe, even though the athlete thinks that the strength training is something that will be beneficial for the athlete, that then it can actually set them up for injuries. So I mean, obviously there is also pros of doing it the other way around, but I think I really like the way that Laurens sees it, and I have just personally experienced only good things about it from the way that we have worked. So I would say strength training in the right way is a good way of making sure that your running is great or become better.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting perspective on strength training for sure. And then the final question about age group triathlon training is, are there some common mistakes that you see that age group triathletes should be aware of and make sure that they avoid that happen to a lot of age groupers?
I think the main thing will actually be maybe focusing less on, I mean, just due to the natural development of our sport, that there is so much focusing on lactate and aerodynamic, different new technologies and so on. And I've just seen with the age group I've worked with, but also just looking on social medias and so on, that they are maybe focusing way more on those small few percentages. And not to say that they don't matter, because they do. But I think if the age group athletes is just able to first focusing on the basics, which is proper food, proper recovery, just doing the basic work load in training and being able to train at the right intensity, then they will maybe get 30 or 40% better instead of getting 5 or 7% better by doing aerodynamic testing and using their money on that, or buying lactate meters and taking lactate measurements if they don't understand it, because you also need to have an understanding of that. So I would say stick to the basics first and do that for a couple of years. And then when you're able to manage that, then you can add on the other layers of a foundation to becoming the best version of yourself.
Yeah, for sure. Now let's move on to discussing Magnus's training in Tacona, which I'm sure a lot of people are really excited to hear more about. So if you can start with just an overview. The last race, for context, that Magnus did before Kona was T100 London, which was at the end of July, I believe, so about 3 months before Kona. So he had a big three-month block there. So can you give an overview of what he did and what the training looked like in that period?
Yeah, so I think actually, because what we did those 3 months in Tacona was actually something that, like, we had prepared for doing that preparation. So basically, the whole 2024 season has been with the eyes on Kona 1.5 weeks ago. So we kind of really wanted to actually use Challenge Roth, which he has won 2 years prior before this year. And then eventually he won again this year and set a new world record, that we wanted to use Challenge Roth as kind of a test of the protocol, which we wanted to do leading into Kona. So basically, we wanted him to go into altitude for 5 to 6 weeks and then come down from altitude, do some heat training and acclimatization before going into Roth. So what we did was that he went into the Boulder. Actually, it's higher up than Boulder, because I believe Boulder is 1,700 meters of altitude. But from doing some altitude testing and training camp in, I believe it was in Fort-Vemur, leading into PTO Ibiza in 2023. We didn't actually see any magnificent changes in his blood values or performing results after doing that altitude block up in Fort-Vemur. So we decided that we wanted to go up even higher to see if actually he was able to get some positive response on the altitude. So that's why we decided to go to the Netherlands in Colorado, which is basically half an hour drive up from Boulder up a mountain. And I think it's in 2,700 meters of altitude. And actually up there, there is also a pool.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really high up. And there is even a pool actually in 3,000 meters of altitude. He only swam there a couple of times though, because it is just so demanding. I mean, even swimming in Boulder in the altitude is quite demanding, because you naturally don't breathe the whole time as you're doing on the bike and the run. So it is quite demanding for the body. But yeah, being up in altitude for 5 to 6 weeks, getting in a good block of training and kind of dialing in and testing out a few training sessions and training blocks to see how he would respond well into it. But then when we're going into Kona, we obviously also have the heat stress factor, which we needed to take into consideration. So we wanted to go down 2 weeks after the altitude and kind of do a 2 weeks heat acclimatization before going into Roth. So what he did was that he went down, did some heat training indoor leading into Roth, and kind of testing and going into the lab after Roth to also see. One thing was the performance side of it and how he raced, but also just getting some good data on how his body responded to it. And we saw some really beneficial data and values across both his performance and data in the lab. So, I mean, that protocol was basically what we wanted to duplicate going into Kona, because it worked so well. I mean, the race in T100 London was basically a survival race. And to be honest, I mean, not to be arrogant or so, but he actually had a really bad race. I know he came fourth position, but just looking at pure numbers, it it was like he wasn't even able to produce his challenge Roth power numbers on the bike, for instance. That was also why he couldn't break away on the bike with Sam. So coming away with fourth place was kind of a relief, because we knew that coming off Roth and everything that follows with that race is quite difficult to recover from. So after London, we decided to take 1 or 2 weeks easy off to kind of settle and recharge the batteries. And then he took to the Netherlands and Colorado. And to be honest, the training just went to absolutely perfection. I mean, to give out some numbers, Magnus was able to, on average, I think, train 33 to 34 hours across those 6 weeks on average. And should remember that this is in 2,700 meters of altitude. So it's quite a demanding stress to the body. But we obviously knew from the preparation we did into Roth that his body was able to cope with it. And I think from what we saw and what was maybe a bit surprising was that when he got to such high altitude in the Roth block, that it took him quite a while to kind of settle into the altitude. And I believe that on his first run up there in altitude going into Roth, he basically just had to walk the first run he did, because just walking up there with the hills and so on was like his heart rate was basically in an easy aerobic run intensity. But then the second time he got there, like even on the first run, he just felt so much better. He was obviously also, from a physiological perspective, he was also in a better position leading into the Roth preparation. We just came home from Singapore, where he broke his wrist on a training crash, and obviously that brought him back fitness wise a bit. So he was in a better position. So he was able to, way earlier on in the camp, being able to get into a better rhythm and intensity on the camp. And everything basically just ran smoothly, and he was able to produce some numbers which we normally see at sea level quite early on. And there we knew that, okay, this this is very, very good. So across that, we were really, really happy about how things went along. And then he basically flew from Denver airport, close to where he was in altitude, directly to Kona. And I joined him from Copenhagen, flying to Kona 2 weeks before the race. So we were able to get in the heat acclimatization. What we did actually was that, just to not go directly from altitude down to the heat in Kona, was that we, in the last week of the altitude block, we decided to implement a bit of heat training just to make sure that his body was a bit adapted to it, so it wasn't too big of a shock. But actually, it was quite hot and humid actually in Boulder, because he was doing some kind of training down at a little bit less altitude there. So combined with some indoor heat training, and also the fact that we have now been practicing heat training and found a pretty good protocol for that over the last 2 years since he did his first Ironman in Texas back in 2022. That was where we did our first heat protocol. And together with our experts in our team, we have managed to get kind of a good idea of how to approach it. So I think, and this also goes with altitude and other stresses that you can put into your body, that the more experienced you are in doing it, the easier it is for your body to kind of dial into it and respond on it. So just by doing a little bit of heat training, his body got used to it quite easy or fast compared to what it's done in prior. We should also remember that when he won his T100 Miami race in the beginning of the year, and also traveling to Singapore afterwards, that was two really, really hot races. So going into those, we basically did 5 weeks of indoor heat training in Denmark leading into Miami. And then, because Singapore obviously is really hot as well, we decided to continue the heat protocol. So in that period of time, he basically did 8 or 9 weeks of very specific heat protocol training, basically almost every day. So he was quite adapted to it. And then, we got to Kona, and again, pretty early on, I mean, I think even after 1 or 2 days, his heart rate and numbers and everything just looked really, really good. I mean, compared to the last time we were in Kona 2 years ago, his body naturally just needed even like I think close to 7 or 9 days to acclimatize to the heat. Obviously, he's in a way better fitness standpoint than what he was 2 years ago, and combining with altitude. Obviously, when even though that he was going, or we were going into heat in Kona, we should also remember that we were replacing the stress factor from the altitude with the heat. So it's not because there was added on another component of stress to his body, because we were taking one stress element away and putting in another, or putting on another stress element of the heat. So that worked out really, really well. And yeah, everything in Kona eventually worked out perfectly. We got in the specific sessions as we wanted, and we have learned by, I would say, not necessarily our mistakes, but just experience within the Kona World Championship 2 years ago and in Nice, the World Championship there 1 year ago, that we have learned from our experiences and mistakes by making sure that everything around Magnus is styled into perfection. For instance, the first year we were in Kona, it was only Magnus and me, and that kind of meant that I was not only in charge of being there for Magnus and coaching him, but also managing like cleaning and groceries and everything. And when you're away for 3.5 weeks together, then doing that as one person, because Magnus obviously needed to focus 100% of his training, was just too much for me. And I think that in the end negatively influenced some things leading into the race. So this year we had his mom with us, who basically cooked and made all the cleaning and grocery shopping. So Magnus could focus in 100% on his training. I could focus in 100% of my job of being there for Magnus. We also had his girlfriend there, who also helped it out. We had a mechanic from Scott who traveled in there and arrived the same day as we did, to make sure that, yeah, he was, this may be a side story, but he's a really cool guy working for Scott. And he was basically polishing and taking care of the bike from early morning to late night, and just making sure everything was running smoothly. They did some aerodynamic testing. So everything around Magnus was just dialed into perfection. And Jens, his coach, came in 6 days before the race. So yeah, everything was just running exactly as we wanted. He was in a good headspace. Training was going perfectly. And I mean, what happened on race day, I mean, it's not because we're disappointed with the second place. Yeah, I'm sorry, Michael, if I'm just moving across to the result. I don't know if you have any questions.
No, you go on. I have some questions in my head that will come back to you later.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, with that, it was just, Magnus came in, as many others, to win the race. So with the character Magnus is and the way we operate as a team, I mean, we always operate to win on race day, but we can't decide what other athletes are doing. But I think with the cards we had to play on race day, I mean, we couldn't be more happy about the result. From what I can read on social medias and speaking with people are a little bit like, oh, damn, Magnus and Christian, they just rode with their head under their arms and everything, but to be honest, like if Sam, Magnus and Christian just sat in the pack, I would believe that Patrick would run away from them either way. So they wouldn't win the race. And we should remember that those three, and including Patrick, they're racing to win. And in interviews going into the race, Magnus had put quite a lot of emphasis on the fact that he thought that he was in a position where he was able to run away from Sam if they came into T2 together, and he believed that Sam had the same intention, or believed that he could run away from Magnus if they entered T2 together. But I believe that Sam wasn't necessarily as confident in his run as we maybe believed. So I think by Magnus saying that, like Sam, he knew that he needed a gap to Magnus, but Magnus also knew from what happened in Nice last year that he can't let Sam have a gap because he runs really well. So they were playing this cat and mouse game. And on the other hand, we had Christian, who I know or believe that he knows that he can also not just let Sam ride away or Magnus ride away based on what Magnus has performed in Roth, but also what Sam did in Nice, but what Sam also did in Kona 2 years ago, where Christian couldn't bridge the gap. So they were all just acting with the purpose of winning the race. And I think, honestly, I have so much respect for not only Magnus, but also Sam and Christian for the way they raced, because they could easily have raced for a really safe podium spot, but they raced to win. And that is what we eventually want to see in the end. And also, of course, hats off to Patrick and his team. They played the cards they should with the abilities and capabilities Patrick has as an athlete. So, I mean, based on just pure performance and races we are all racing, we're really happy about the result. But obviously, we want more, and already now we are all locked in on Nice next year, but especially Hawaii in 2 years from now on.
Yeah, no, that's a great overview. Thank you for that. Yeah, so some follow up questions. With the heat training, you don't have to go into detail because I guess that's a bit proprietary, but was it all active heat training, or did you also use some sort of passive heat training like sauna or mix of the two?
I mean, I can actually be quite specific about it because I think it is not something, I mean, people can try and duplicate it, but you need to see this in the bigger picture. And this is something that we have evolved upon over the last couple of years. So the heat training we are doing now is not what we did 2 years ago, because if we did that, it would be too big of a stress for his body. So what we are doing now is basically that he gets close to 40 to 60 minutes of a heat exposure a day. That is a mix of both sauna and also riding indoor with a lot of clothes on. And then we have a lot of measurements in terms of where we want his body core temperature to be at. And again, this is a very individual thing where we want his body core temperature to be at, and it can be quite individual from person to person. So this is something we have built upon the last 2 years, and I think it's the same with altitude. Like, it's not just everyone that can go up to 2,700 meters of altitude and be there for six weeks. That is also something that we have built upon for years now. So I mean, it is actually quite basic. It was just, I think, two saunas a week, close to 40 minutes, basically sitting in there as much as possible. And if needed, he could go out and have a cold exposure to cool himself down, and then back into the sauna to make sure that it was not like an all-out effort to be in there, because cardiovascularly, it's actually also quite a high stress for the body. And then the rest of the sessions was five indoor turbo sessions. Basically, it was not because he did any intensity by doing the heat, like intensity while having the heat protocol or the heat training. I have seen some people have done that, but we have not successfully seen good benefits with that. I think adding on heat and high intensity, it's a really big stress for the body, which is difficult to absorb and adapt to. So it was basically for most parts of the last hour of his rides, whether that would be an intensity ride or easy ride, he would be layering up and then just sit there and sweat quite a lot. Yeah.
And one final follow up on that: do you use the core sensor to monitor the core body temperature, or do you use some probes or pills, or what do you use?
Yeah, so it's been a mixture. We have both used the pills and the core sensor. I mean, the core sensor is a good tool, but we have also seen like sometimes it can deviate a bit from the pills. And I would highly say that the pills is way more accurate. Not to say that the core sensor isn't a great tool, because it is, but I think it maybe still needs some years of development to make sure that it's 100% valid. So we used a mixture of those things, but in Kona, for instance, we used the pills way more to make sure that we have the correct data, and I was able to see how the cooling strategies and everything was working.
Then the other question, related to the team around Magnus and how you now, compared to 2 years ago, had more people around helping. Do you think that, looking at the top of the professional racing, is it even possible to be competitive if you don't have, I mean, different top athletes have different teams, right? Sam is more, he's kind of a family team, but he still has a team and obviously help from sponsors and so on. Is it a necessity in this day and age in professional triathlon to build that team around you, no matter how you do it? But you need, it has to be a team effort, not just one coach or one
one person helping out.
In my eyes, yeah, and I must, maybe I'm a bit biased to it, of course, but that is also just the way that I'm working, whether it will be with Magnus, Ruth, George, my junior athletes, etc. I've always believed in having a strong team behind you. And I think this is also where it differs between being a professional athlete and being like a high performance athlete, because I believe there is a lot of professional athletes out there, but I don't believe there is too many high performance athletes out there. And I think maybe Jan was one of the guys who really broke that barrier of going from a professional athlete to high performance athlete by securing that you had the right team around you, going into like all the details, turning every stone. So yeah, I don't believe that you can win the biggest races without being a high performance athlete, having the right team around you, dialing everything in, because at the end of the day, Magnus is, of course, really much involved in all the, if we're still talking about the case with Magnus, Magnus is, of course, still involved in many of, let's say, the projects that we are working on as a team. But he's also now trying to let go a bit more. And we have kind of made sure that the people around him is people that he trusts. So we have experts and people across all areas, which is really like strong experts in their given area. And Magnus has also needed to be able to kind of let go, because if he was kind of, you can say, involved 100% in all projects, he wouldn't really necessarily be able to perform to his best capability in training. So this has also been a learning process where sometimes he just needs to acknowledge that his engineer is like trusting 100%, 110% in what he is doing, and say, okay, the decisions that he is taking is the ones that is also right for me. And the same goes to me or Jens or so on, that the decisions we decide to make, for instance, there was a session where Magnus was a little bit in doubt whether like he should stop or we should just continue, because he was feeling really good. But what is the interest in continuing and maybe put a too much strain to your body, etc. Then like I needed to take a decision that we are in a good position. We stop now. And then he just needs to believe in the fact that I'm taking this decision based on evidence and my opinion of what is most important, and not necessarily drag too much about whether it will be a right or wrong decision. The same goes to his bike setup and so on. Obviously, he has some ideas, but if there's experts that are saying that this is the fastest and you feel comfortable within it, then you just have to go with it. And he has to be like, okay, that's what we're doing. And then he's focusing on his task with his swim bike and run to the fastest of his ability.
Yeah, yeah. Coming back to the training leading into Kona then, so you said 33, 34 hours at altitude. What was the breakdown between swim, bike, and run, roughly speaking, among those hours of training?
I maybe actually have to open Training Peaks while we are talking. I think I can be quite. I don't. Do you want like an overview of the training into details, or just like across the disciplines?
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, we can kind of. Yeah, this was basically his last week before we were traveling into Kona. So that was a 33-hour training week where it was over. He swam 25 kilometers. He rode 426 kilometers and he ran 131 kilometers. And that was basically like balanced it out on like Monday is usually, you can say, I wouldn't say a recovery day, but it's like an easier aerobic day after a big weekend. So Monday he had a 6K easy swim, focusing on quite a lot of technique. Then he had a 1 hour strength training session and then a 1 hour easy run. So that is basically just to maintain some aerobic base and make sure that it will set him up well for the Tuesday. And then the way that we or Jens and him kind of decided to schedule the week was that we still believe that it's quite important to keep the threshold, the LT2, up quite high. And then more on the weekend, focusing more on like efficient Ironman pace and get efficient at race pace. So the middle block of the week was mainly focusing on threshold. So his Tuesday was a 4-hour ride with some longer threshold intervals at this part of, like you can say, a specific preparation with threshold. It's not only doing, let's say, threshold work, but doing longer, extensive threshold work. So it, at this ride, it was 3x15 minutes LT2, and then he finished off with just 3x2 minutes LT2. So a little bit more high intensity threshold by the end, but mainly still working with those longer efforts. And then he finished off after that 4-hour ride. He recovered, and then in the evening he ran a 1-hour and 5-minute jog with like some 200 meter strides to towards the end. That was Tuesday. Then on the Wednesday, kind of the two key sessions, so to say, was a threshold progressive swim up to VO2 max, followed by a threshold run. So on the swim, it was a 5K swim with 10 times 200 threshold, kind of keeping it at a fairly short descending time. And then like going into 15 times 100, where you're kind of progressing from threshold to VO2 and also working on getting efficient at a faster speed, even though that you're tired. And this was also to kind of simulate the end of the Kona swim, because sometimes we have seen that by the end of a championship swim, some of the stronger swimmers is trying to increase the pace. So this is a really good resilience set when you are kind of wanting to create kind of some fatigue over a long main set and then building to VO2. And then after that threshold set, he went out for a threshold run. This was done at like a flat section where he did 3x10 minutes threshold, 2 minutes recovery, going into 3x2 minutes threshold with a very short break as well. So that was, 1-hour, 20-minute run across 17 kilometers. And then by the end of the day, he finished off with, a 2-hour easy ride. Then the first day, an easy 4K swim, but it was mainly still with the focusing on working on the speed. So there was a combined speed work of 300 meters divided into 50 meter max with the like max effort, focusing still on great technique with 3x100 easy in between those 50 meter reps. And then the rest of it was just easy aerobic work. Then after the swim, because he swam in Boulder, he had like his long run, which was 1 hour and 45 minutes, only 21 kilometers, but he ran from Boulder, the pool, up to where he lived in altitude. So that is basically, 21 kilometers uphill, easy running, but really good to create some run efficiency and also working on strength and movement pattern. So that's a really good way of doing it. And obviously, coming off a swim, he already had some fatigue and 2 other stays in the system. And then he finished off with a 2-hour easy ride by the end of the day. Then Friday, again, it's not because Friday and Monday, as I said, is a rest day, but it's an easier day. There isn't too much intensity. Though he had an open water swim in the morning, a 5K open water swim, where he did 4x1 kilometer at kind of LT1 Ironman pace. But again, it's quite a sustainable effort if you're actually doing it at your LT1. So working in the open water, practicing the skills of navigating. And he was in the Netherlands, Colorado with some great training mates, where one of them is a really strong short distance guy who's swimming crazy fast. So he was able to kind of go on to the feet of him and being able to draft there. Then he yet again had his strength training, 1 hour strength training, and then finished off with a 1 hour and 10 easy run, which was 1 hour easy aerobic, and then followed up by some 200 meter strides by the end. Then we come to the Sunday, which is the weekend, which is kind of where the big Ironman base work is done. So he did a 200 kilometer ride in 5 hours and 22 minutes, which basically is 4 hours culminated Ironman pace divided over those 5 hours and 22 minutes with some breaks, mainly just to actually refuel with energy and hydration. So 5 hours across Ironman pace on that ride. And then in the evening, another easy 1 hour run just to shake out the legs from from the Ironman bike session and make sure that get in some more aerobic stimuli and make sure that his legs is firing for the following day, which was an easy swim in the morning, going into kind of his last big Ironman run workout, which was 6 times 6 kilometers at Ironman pace, kind of simulating the Queen K run course for the Ironman Hawaii, because if the listeners out there has been there, like, there is basically really no way where it's flat. It's really either up or down. So he ran this six times 6K at Ironman pace, undulating between running a little bit downhill and running uphill. So in total, that was a 40.2 kilometer run in 2 hours and 43 minutes. And then he finished off with 1.5 hours of easy riding with some, yeah, this was where we started our heat protocol. So where he did 1 hour of heat training. So yeah, that was basically 33 hours and 22 minutes of training leading into the Ironman Hawaii. And then the following week and the weekend, we traveled to Hawaii for the race.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for breaking that down. That's really interesting to hear. And the final question on Magnus's preparation is, was there anything in this preparation that you would say that this was a hit, this worked really, really well? And likewise, was there anything, or vice versa, was there anything that you think that this is something we could do better next time?
To be honest, there is not really, obviously we're still in a phase now where we are digesting everything from the race, and we are really self-critic to ourselves, and we always want to do better. And I think when we analyze this in depth, there might be some things we could do better. But just looking at it now and where I stand now and where we stand as a team, I don't think that there is too much we could have done differently. I mean, I remember being out for a run with Magnus the days before the race, and we were kind of discussing everything, and we said to each other that nevertheless, if he would win the race or become third place or so, like, we can look each other in the eyes by the end of the day and say, okay, we did all we could. We basically did nothing wrong. And that was actually also what we did after the race. Before we went to bed, we kind of gave each other a hug and be like, man, we did everything we could. We couldn't beat the PL5, but maybe another time. So honestly, at this point, there isn't too much we want to do differently. But I think if you ask me in 2 or 3 months, I maybe have a different perspective.
Right. And then just a few shorter, more personal reflective questions to finish off. The first one is, we're quickly coming up on Christmas. So if you have to put one triathlon related thing on your wish list, what would that be?
That's a difficult one. I think maybe actually some more books. I've recently trying to get more into books and reading stuff, not necessarily about triathlon, because I think with my work I can easily get caught up too much in triathlon. So I'm trying to kind of not seek new hobbies, but trying to learn more about just people in general. So that will maybe be like a book about whether it will be performance or mental careness or something like that, I think.
Yeah, I think classic, but Anti-Fragile is a really good one that could work. Or maybe, what is the new one by Adam Grant? Something about potential. I can't remember the name, but that one is really good as well.
Yeah, you can send them through to me. That would be really good.
Is there something in particular, a particular topic that you're trying to learn more about or focus on at the moment?
Yeah, I think actually building, this might sound maybe a bit odd, but I'm actually trying to build a team around myself, because I think even as crucial as it is for an athlete as we have been into, to have a team of great people around you, then I also think for myself it's quite important to have a great support from my family and loved ones in order to perform at my work. And also, like, I need people, like, at least that what I'm feeling, I feel like I need people in my corner that is expert in different areas, which then allows me to focusing at what I'm good at. Because like, I think one of my strengths is that I know that I don't need everything, and I know that I need people around me. So like, I need people to be there for me, in which allows me to be able to relax and focusing on my work, because I'm traveling so much and so on. So having a supportive network and team and family around me is something that I have paid way more dividend to. And that's also why I, for instance, have moved to Aarhus with my girlfriend, to be around her more, and also just people and family and so on.
Yeah. And the final question, choose one of these two, either what is the best or most influential book that you've read, or the best advice that you've ever received.
Yeah, I think if we speak in the next year or so, I will be able to come up with a book. But as of for now, I would say the best advice I've been given is maybe to be patient. It's quite a simple one, but I think the more I take it into consideration and focusing on it, then the more patient I am, the more it also seems to me that there is occurring great chances of being able to execute to the best of my ability.
Brilliant. I think that's it. Is there anything else, any final things? Where can people follow you on social media and elsewhere on the internet?
Yeah, I'm using Instagram now and then, and people can follow me there. It's pretty simple. Maybe one of the most Scandinavian names out there, Kasper Henrik Petersen, just in one go. And yeah, then I use Strava sometimes to get in some training myself. It's not because people will see magnificent like paces or powers in there, but I try to be active and post things about coaching and also just the podcast, etc., in there as well. So people can follow me there, but otherwise I hope to see people out there on the race course.
Brilliant. Yeah, hope to see you on the race course, Kasper. Thank you so much for
this. You too, Michael.
And speak to you later. I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to several related episodes, including some episodes on altitude training and heat preparation protocols. And as Kasper also mentioned, he during the interview, he talked about my interview with Torben Rokkedal Laus, and that is a really good interview with another prominent Danish coach that, if you enjoyed this one, I'm sure you will enjoy that one too, if you haven't listened to it already. Just a little bit of promotion here of some of the things we do at Scientific Triathlons that keep the lights on. And one of the highlights of what we do for all of us is our training camps. And no matter where the camp is, we always have the goal that you will come away from it a fitter athlete, a more skilled athlete. And to that end, we do swim video analysis usually. And we also, of course, do a decent amount of descending on the bike. And we want you to come home from the camp as a more fulfilled and happy athlete by getting you to have one of the most enjoyable training weeks of your life in a great group of like-minded people. And that we can bring back to something that we talked about many times on this podcast, which is the biopsychosocial model of performance, where being happy, being in a good social environment, and enjoying your training, that also contributes greatly to driving fitness adaptations. So this is something that really shouldn't be underestimated, and that we put a lot of focus into, just as we do the actual training. So next year we will have two training camps. The first one is in Mallorca from the 5th to the 12th of April, and then we have one in the Algarve in Portugal from the 26th of April to the 3rd of May. And you can find all the details of both of these camps on scientifictriathlon.com under the training camps menu, where you can also register by filling out the registration form on the respective camp page. If you're not sure which camp is right for you, or you have any other questions or things to discuss before signing up, then you can always email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and I'll be more than happy to assist and discuss. And hopefully I get to meet you. I'm very excited for it on one of our camps in 2025. In the next episode of That Triathlon Show, we will have actually a very similar theme to this one, but with a different guest. I interview Rob Cheatham, who coaches Leon Chevalier, among others. And one of the topics that we discuss is Leon's Kona preparation, like we did here with Magnus's Kona preparation. Leon was fourth in the end in Kona, and so that's a very interesting preparation to look at in detail, like we did here today.
And we, of course, have a bunch of other topics as well that we discuss with Rob, including some age group related coaching advice and so on and so forth. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.